Welcome to the Campus Ministry Heritage and History Podcast Series from Dominican University of California. This podcast series has been organized by Sister Mary Sower and is made possible through the joint effort of Campus Ministry, the Communication and Media Studies Department, and Penguin Radio.
So welcome to this 2021 Spring Dominican Heritage and History Lecture sponsored by Campus Ministry. I'm Sister Mary Sower, the director. Father Edward Skillebeck, a Dominican theologian from Belgium, wrote that the story of Dominicans can only be kept alive by live Dominicans. And we at Campus Ministry also believe in the gift of storytelling, as does our final speaker for the series this academic year, Dr. Cynthia Taylor. Dr. Taylor is an assistant professor of history in the School of Liberal Arts and Education. She wrote a chapter for the book, Preaching with Their Lives, Dominicans on Mission in the United States After 1850. And her partner in this endeavor is Eileen Purcell, a labor organizer and co-founder of the Sanctuary Movement in the 1980s. Thank you to both of you for sharing your story of how the Dominican Sisters of San Rafael, founders of the university, engaged in the Sanctuary Movement. So Eileen, you've asked us to begin with a video. Would you tell us a little bit about this, please?
I would be happy to. Thank you so much, Sister Mary. The video is 4 minutes, and it was commissioned by the San Francisco Interfaith Council of Churches in 2015-16, and it was by Theo Rigby, a film student and now graduate of Stanford. And again, it captures the Sanctuary Movement of the 80s by interviewing some of us who started it then, but brings us up to the present and the challenges we face in our country today. So it's 4 minutes.
The Sanctuary Movement has a long trajectory. It grew out of the Hebrew Scriptures. It grew out of the Underground Railroad, the Civil Rights Movement. It was a group of people coming together and asking, what does our faith tradition tell us as we meet the times in which we live? How do I live on the prophetic edge? In 1980, the war in Central America was erupting. You saw an exodus of Salvadorans and Guatemalans fleeing those war-ravaged countries.
June 27, 1980, the death squads came to my town with 5 names, you know, including mine. I fortunately was not at home, but the other 4 of my classmates were at home and they were killed that night. In 24 hours, I was out of the country. After 3 months, I ended up here in the United States.
The incantation of the Reagan administration was that we were fighting communism in El Salvador.
If you were a refugee from Cuba or from Nicaragua, you will get political asylum. But if you were a refugee from El Salvador or from Guatemala, 98% of the cases will be denied.
March 24th, 1980, Oscar Romero, the beloved archbishop, was assassinated while saying mass. Several months later, 4 U.S. church women were killed and raped. The whole Catholic community and beyond was shocked.
We had to do something. We began gathering our folks. We would invite a refugee to come and sit in the middle of them and tell their story. After a year, we had a secret vote to become a sanctuary parish.
Number of people involved were thousands. People were raising their hand and said, what can I do? What else can I do?
In San Francisco, our objective was not necessarily to help people across the border. Our objective was to integrate them into our community.
You had police chiefs and sheriffs really understand
that it wasn't their job to enforce federal immigration law, that it was their job to protect the public safety in the communities, and that in order to do that, they had to build trust with those communities.
We still have a very broken federal immigration system. We still have a system that is not offering a path to legalization or a path to citizenship. We're asking faith communities to form accompaniment teams, a team that would pledge to support a family or a youth for a year and to walk alongside immigrants in whatever their greatest needs are.
I don't feel we can be neutral bystanders on this. We need to tap back into the energy, follow the example of Pope Francis, and become prophetic. We see the value, the dignity, the beauty of our immigrant community. But we have to go further than that. We have to stand up and denounce injustice.
Okay, thank you. Good. Thank you, Eileen, for that film. I enjoy it every time I see it. It brings back a lot of memories about this project. Hello, I'm Cynthia Taylor, and I just want to share about four things, kind of give a context, and then I want to switch it over to Eileen, who was there in the 1980s, as were the sisters. So I'll just give you a little bit idea of how this project or this paper or this chapter came about. Basically, I was motivated to do this because I took the 2014 Fanjo trip. And I'll remember it was quite a powerful experience because you're there in the south of France where Saint Dominic was, and the sisters, and one is Sister Patty is a major organizer of this trip, and she and the sisters there really helped you understand that you were walking in the footsteps of Saint Dominic. And you really are. I really was. And it was like a pilgrimage. So I was profoundly moved by this. And the idea of the trip, it's a gift. You know, I was given this gift to go. I was chosen as a faculty member that year. And along with a staff person, I think there was someone from administration. There's usually a student. Well, it was a gift. And at the end, you know, the sisters ask you, what are you going to do with this knowledge? What are you going to do with this gift? You've walked in the footsteps of St. Dominic. What can you do with this? So there's kind of a reverse mission aspect of this. So I came back to campus thinking about this, you know, what can I do? And I think in that fall semester, must have been 2014, I got this email saying that there Dominican scholars out of the McGreal Center, I think it was Chicago area, they wanted they were writing the second volume of Dominicans on Mission. And up until that point, there's this volume about Dominican history and volume one, and they were starting volume two. So I was very aware of this first volume. And so I just thought, oh, I'll do that. And the first thing that popped into my mind, because this was about Dominicans on Mission, and I thought, well, I know they were active in the sanctuary movement. And I am not a scholar of the sanctuary movement. I am, my scholarship is in other areas, mostly the connection between religious belief and social activism, prophetic,
like some of the people said in there. So, but this comes out of my teaching liberation theology for many years on campus. And so I just somehow I knew that they participated, but I had no idea of what that meant. And so so I came back and I just thought, I made a proposal, and you know, I was surprised that they accepted it. And I am one of 14 stories in this book. And I've got to tell you, of some very, very, very fine scholars, it was a little intimidating sitting in the meetings with these other scholars that really knew Dominican history, or it was something else. And I thought, oh boy. But, you know, I knew I had the sisters to help me. And so I just started at the scratch. You know, I do feel that my chapter is basically primary source research. It's not, I don't think, I can ask Eileen about this, but frankly, the secondary research on sanctuary movement has to be done. It's just not where it should be. But anyway, I interviewed the sisters. I went to their archives. They shared with me. So I had oral interviews. So it was a combination of what I could find. And I had a limited time that summer, but all of them told me about Eileen. And I think my real find that semester was Eileen. So I'm so happy that she's here with us today, because she was there. And you think about it, I'm looking at it 30 years, you know, it was 30 years in the past, or more than 30 years in the past. But so I just started, you know, and again, it was motivated by my understanding of sanctuary movement as an aspect of liberation theology, but not, but something I wanted to know more about. So I went about it, and I want to just share with you what I think is very interesting is, as an historian, I saw three distinctive periods of the sisters' development here, that, well, the San Rafael Dominican sisters. And I just want to say that just a little thing about the history, because I find this personally very interesting, and I think it's something we should all know on campus. But basically, the sisters are as old as California. They came to as old as modern California, statehood California, right? They must have been pioneers. They appeared in 1850. They were the pioneers in 1850. So that just fascinated me. And so this first, I call this the pioneer days, 1850 to about the late 1880s, in which they just, again, with all the pioneers at that time were there. They moved around, but it was by the 1890, which, you know, we know is the founding of Dominican College or Dominican University here, 1890. So this year, the sisters had the grasp of being where the center was, and so they moved to different places, and but Benicia, they moved to San Rafael just because they understood that the political power was going to be here in the Bay Area. So they wanted to, the sisters want to be where the action is. So so then from 1890 to about 1960, this was the expansion period, not just only of our campus here, but also the sisters' work in the infrastructure of California, the building of schools and hospitals primarily. That was their mission. So there's just so much that can be said about these building years. And then I noticed a shift and change in the 1960s because of Vatican II. And this was a third turning point for the Dominican sisters as they began to rethink their mission. Their mission before was, working personally, building, being teachers, preaching, going out and doing that public work, the infrastructure building, I call it. But this change in Vatican II, from the way I understood what the sisters were telling me, this was an inward move about their mission. What exactly was their mission? And one of the things was, based on our values of study, reflection, community and service, the sisters looked within. And as Sister Carla told me, a very important document out of Vatican II is Perfecte Caritatis. And they look back to the example of St. Dominic to think about how were they going to respond to the events of the 50s and 60s. So this required, as the film shows, a public stance. Because not that they were private, but what they were doing was one-on-one with these building and schools. But suddenly there was this kind of desire to go public. And a theme, what I saw in the archives, a big theme of their meetings in these late 50s, early 60s was hear the cry of the poor. This became kind of, you might say, a mantra, hear the cry of the poor. And so these sisters began to just say, what can I do? And so I think that my chapter of my book is really called the Dominican Sisters of San Rafael Taking a Corporate Stance for Social Justice. Because I learned from the sisters their deep, deep commitment to democracy, that they when they decide to do something, they decide as a whole, as a corporate body. And so I learned about what a corporate stance was. And the awareness that taking a public stance or a corporate stance and belong to this emerging sanctuary movement that was certainly here in the Bay Area, it was down in Arizona. It was out in Chicago. And there was these different hubs where the sanctuary movement was emerging. But here in the Bay Area, the sisters were very much kind of within this motion. Because, what's happening in the 80s is, like the film said, the death of Oscar Romero, murder, refugees coming to the Bay Area. It was Reagan and his policy. So it was pretty dire, like what's going on today. So listen, I'll just finish up. The sisters were very aware that they were going against the INS, against the corporate, the Reagan administration's policies, as you talked about in the film. So this required commitment. And again, I'm going to turn it over to Eileen because she was there when it happened. Eileen came over to my office. We talked on the phone. She shared with me documents. So she she really filled me in on the story. And I tell that story in my chapter, so I'll hope you all read it. And but I just want to say that when I finally did finish writing my chapter, it was 2016 by that time. And everything, we all remember 2016. And I couldn't believe how sanctuary was everywhere. And I thought it just was so relevant. And I just couldn't believe it, that this was so relevant. And I want to turn it now over to Eileen, but I want to say that this is what Eileen and I, what I talked about was the 1980s movement. But I was simply amazed at how sanctuary, the legacy of it is everywhere present. And I think it's because of the activism like Eileen. So I couldn't go on. I haven't been able to go on to the next phase, but maybe that's something we can talk about today. But without further ado, let me just turn it over to Eileen. And again, here's it just was a joy to meet her and all the help she gave me with what happened in the 1980s.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I'm very honored and humbled. And thank you all for joining us on your lunch break. I am a daughter of Dominican. My mother graduated with the first class of Master's in Social Work in 1936. My older sisters, three of them, are graduates of Dominican. And so Dominican has been close to my heart for my entire life. I attended St. Louis Academy in San Francisco and was taught by so many Dominican sisters who were subsequently in leadership. When I graduated, I went to Stanford, I got an MSW myself, and in 1979 was hired by San Francisco Catholic Social Service. And we were experiencing, I was an organizer, I was working with 22 parishes south of Market, and there was this explosion, if you will, of an influx of refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala in particular. And they'd come to San Francisco because of the turbulence, the upheaval across Central America, as endemic poverty and economic violence was meeting military violence. And so you had wars that were catching on and people were either engaging the war or fleeing. And so my job became part of the archdiocesan response. And for 2 years before we even designated anything such as public sanctuary, we did the great work of using the systems in place, and multi-denominations have a great history of refugee resettlement and of welcoming and providing legal services, social services. But in 1980, U.S. policy, even though we had just adopted a refugee act that stipulated that we would no longer infect our decisions about who was a refugee or not with our foreign policy priorities, notwithstanding that we had the 1980 Refugee Act that synchronized our policy with the United Nations Convention, the policy was summary deportation, because people, the Reagan administration, did not want refugees contradicting his position that the governments of Central America, who are our strategic allies, were in conflict with our democratic or human rights values. So for 2 years, in 1980, I was 26. I went to El Salvador to do the needs assessment to make the case to our board of we're going to support why we needed to provide legal and social services, even though these were undocumented, they did not enjoy State Department status. And I spent 3 weeks that changed my life. I met Jean Donovan, one of the four missionaries who was assassinated in December of 1980. I worked with all of our counterparts at the Archdiocese. Now, again, Oscar Romero had just been assassinated. 9 priests had been assassinated. My counterparts were under duress. 1,000 people were being murdered a month. This is a tiny country of 5 million people at the time. So when we came back, we developed a great network, including the Dominican Sisters of San Rafael. We had We knew which hospitals to send people to when there was an emergency and no money. We had schools that said, we can take one, or we can provide tutoring over here. And we did the policy work. We talked with the legislators, but nothing seemed to move the needle when it came to systemic change that would address our immigration policy that was summarily deporting people and denying them their due process. And it was not addressing the root causes, our support of the military, the armed forces, in support of a Cold War geopolitical conflict. So in 1982, we by then had a vast network. We got invited, I got invited by a colleague, a bishop from the Lutheran tradition, to meet with him and talk about what else we could do. And Reverend Gus Schultz was that man, and he was our reference point. He invited me to meet with the pastors of a lectionary group in the East Bay, who coordinated every Sunday what they were going to preach about on Sundays. And he said, you know, back in the 70s, during the Vietnam War, we did something called sanctuary. We had young men and women fearful of going back into that theater of war because it was immoral, but they didn't know what to do, to desert or not. And he provided a safe place for them to come together and meet with lawyers, meet with theologians, meet with priests, sisters, and discern. The centerpiece of the sanctuary movement was the discernment process, and the Dominican sisters are the gold standard of the discernment process. So 1982, five congregations in Berkeley go through, we develop a three-week discernment process. What does our faith tell us? What does the law tell us? What does the Congress, what is the Congress doing? What are the risks? And as a group, each congregation in 1982 assessed, what are we prepared to risk? Because there were risks. We believed that we were complying with U.S. federal law and international law, which said, anyone who flees their homeland for based on a fear of persecution because of race, religion, membership in a political organization, race, there were five criteria, they are entitled to due process. And we were violating that. 98% of all people were deported. So if we violated it and the government said we were in contradiction to the law, we ran the risk of losing our licenses, losing our 501c3 status, losing our donor base. There were serious, significant risks. Five congregations in the Bay Area and one in Tucson, Southside Presbyterian, coordinated, went through that discernment process, elected to declare sanctuary, and decided to do it publicly. And in that discernment was the refugee themselves, people willing to tell their stories. Now, they've been telling their stories for all these years. What was different? In the discernment process, they shared, but then once the congregation said, I'm going to be a public sanctuary, we held press conferences and liturgies and invited the press. We announced it. We enunciated the good news that the individual refugee is not standing alone. We as a community stand with them. We as a community signed a covenant that we would protect, defend, and advocate for the refugees in our midst, that we would accompany them, that we were not only providing a service and a humanitarian impulse, though that was certainly part of the heart of it, but that we were brothers and sisters, sisters and brothers, and that we, it was a mutual partnership. So it was not a top-down, I'm your rescuer. It was a relationship and a covenantal relationship. And the sisters in San Rafael, in many ways, took this to several levels better than any other group I worked with across the country. Not only did they provide a home first for 10 refugees and then later for a family that stayed with the sisters for over 8 years, I believe, and you educated their two children, you gave their jobs to the two parents. But the sisters also, Sister Kristen Wambacher, the leader at one point, your prior general, she came onto my board of directors when I became the head of this Share Foundation. She went with me to El Salvador to accompany villages and communities that were being bombed. We went to visit the people still in the crosshairs in El Salvador. Today, Sisters of Dominican go with us to Honduras, where very similar conditions exist and are frightening. So we discerned, the community prayed, The community looked the risks in the eyes and said, even though we think we're following the law, we're prepared to risk being accused of breaking the law. And all of the attendant consequences. So discernment, and then how, once the sisters made their corporate stand, they joined a growing group of 150 congregations. Later, at the end of the war, we were over 500 congregations. Today, there are over 1,500 congregations that have declared public sanctuary and are reinterpreting what it means in the times in which we're living. And we're all following the news. The great success of sanctuary was that it deepened our communities. It was transnational. We describe it in Martin Luther King's terms as a beloved community. The war ended, and we contributed to that. We reopened 500,000 political asylum cases because we brought litigation against the government, the American Baptist Church case et al. And the sisters may have actually been co-signatories to that class action lawsuit that we raised funds for. We had the National Sanctuary Defense Fund. So we were very successful on one hand, but we failed to change the paradigm. We are seeing the legacy of our wars in Central America and our economic policies today as caravans of Hondurans come to the border with their children and beg for entry, turn themselves in. Because the legacy of those wars is unchanged, and because the architecture of a very repressive immigration system is still in place and has been, if you ask me, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, has shifted from a focus on family reunification. We were trying to get to that more, just, if you will, moral imperative as coming out of World War II that was captured in the international law. But we've shifted to a law and order stance that criminalizes and demonizes the other, the immigrant, the refugee. So today, the work remains as important as ever. The witness remains as important as ever, both individual action and corporate action. If you haven't read it, I encourage everyone to read this last weekend's New York Times Magazine. It was a very, very well done overview. The one mistake, she made two mistakes. One is that sanctuary did not begin at the border, public sanctuary. Sanctuary began in the Bay Area and with one Tucson-based church, which is not to say the work wasn't going on, it was. And I always acknowledge the immigrant communities live sanctuary every day when they open their doors to their own, to their relatives, to the friend of their relatives. My husband was Salvadoran and had a scrap of paper with a phone number of it on it and knocked on a door. They didn't know who he was and they let him in for 3 weeks. And this gets repeated over and over again. So the immigrant community, and often the poorest, are the most generous. What sanctuary did was we packaged it, and the Anglo community and institutions got educated and entered a relationship and put our institutions and our hearts on the line with this community of people seeking both safe haven, but also justice. There's a Latin American writer that said, we don't want charity, we want solidarity. There's a difference. It feels different. Gus Schultz used to say, we emerged from a service model to a partnership model. Once at the border, when refugees were going back from a refugee camp in Honduras, they were returning to El Salvador. The refugee turned to Gus and said, would you bless us? And Gus said, only if you'll bless the U.S. delegation back. When we talk about crossing the border with Jesus, people often think that the refugee is the person who's been beaten and is at the side of the road, and the Good Samaritan comes by and picks him up. Actually, I claim that it could go any way, but the refugee is Jesus. And we're given an opportunity to accompany be part of a journey towards justice in our lives. So it's 10 minutes to one. There's so much more that could be said, but I need to honor our Dominican sisters because they adopted this stance at a time when the U.S. government was indicting religious workers for accompanying Central Americans who were crossing the border. They adopted this system, this covenant, even though he was bishop, but now Cardinal Bevilacqua had sent out a missive to every single bishop saying you must oppose it because you're going to risk our tax-exempt status because the State Department is pressuring us. They did it because they were faithful to their charism of being truth tellers. And I proudly claim my Dominican roots. And I'll turn it back to you, Sister Mary, if you want to MC, or Carol, Cynthia, if you want to add anything, or if there are any sisters on the call who lived this with us and continue to live it. Because I work with Judy and Lynn, who are the heads of the Dominican Sisters. They're just social justice coordinators. The work continues in small and large ways, in private and public ways. Today is different than it was in 1980. Very different political realities. Some of the challenges are the same, some of them are different. So lots to talk about. But back to you, Cynthia and Sister Mary.
I would just say thank you for reminding me. But I remember coming on one document and the sisters had a plan when the INS came knocking at the door. They were always very nice, you know, but, you know, they had a plan about, you know, how they would respond. But it was just, they just thought of everything. But yeah, they were very aware that they were taking a risk. And but their idea, hear the cry of the poor, that they had a higher mission, I think, and again, all of them, not everyone agreed, but enough, you know, 75%, you know, had voted to go forward. And so there's a lot of trust on those that might have been afraid, but
part of the process
reminded me of all those things.
We were very intentional about inviting our sisters or any congregation to name our fears. What do we fear? What are some of the consequences? And there were serious assets at risk when you think about the incredible work of the Dominican Sisters in education and healthcare. Those are formidable institutions. And there were tremendous pressure being brought by certain groups. So we were explicit. What are we most afraid of? And some, I don't want to go to jail. I hate jail myself. I don't like getting arrested. I don't like civil. I mean, we have different callings, right? But we were explicit. And then we listed, what are our hopes? Where do we get strength? And there was no wrong answer. So we encouraged this deep, both intellectual honesty, but also heartfelt. We created space to explore privately and in community. And I believe that's why the sanctuary communities that spent the most time in the discernment process have had the longest term commitment to this work and ministry. It didn't stop when the war ended. It didn't stop 20 years later. We're still working together in various expressions.
It's still their corporate stance.
Thank you both so much for what you've shared so far. Does anyone have a question or would like to offer additional information from your backgrounds or perspectives? We have a few minutes. Eileen has a 1 o'clock Zoom that she's jumping off to, but she said she can stick around for a few more minutes.
One of the fears while you think about your question was that, oh gosh, if we do this, it'll divide the community or we'll lose support. Just so you know, the other error in this magazine was it said when they indicted the religious workers, they were it was a setback for the movement. In fact, the opposite is true. Once they indicted the religious workers, mostly from the border towns, there was an explosion of interest. So we went from 150 congregations to over 500 congregations and national denominational offices and Catholic Charities National. So, I mean, it just brought a laser beam focus to what does it mean to be faithful in these times.
Sophia, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I wanted to say hi, Eileen. I don't know if you remember me, but I worked at the Share Foundation for a couple of years. So when I saw that you were speaking today, I was like, oh, I'm so excited to reconnect. And yeah, I just wanted to commend you again and send Jose my best of just how inspiring it is of like what the sanctuary movement has become and how it still is so present today. I joined Share in 2016. And so that was so like such a big learning experience of like, how do we face all of these adversities and still give honor to people at the most like humane level of providing them with the services they need. And I had the honor to go on a delegation as well in 2017. And just El Salvador holds such a big place in my heart. So thank you again for sharing.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. First of all, thank you. Very, very informative from both of you. Appreciate that. First question is, I was doing some digging on Sanctuary City. They keep citing the Presbyterian Church in Tucson, as you mentioned, as like the first one. So are you all going to, you know, request edits on Wikipedia and all these different things so we can get San Rafael on there as well? So that's question number one. And then number two is, does Reagan's immigration policy in 86, the amnesty portion of that, does that play a role here? I know you're mostly talking about sort of the early 80s, but I'm curious where that fits in.
Eileen, ask that second question. You might know about the amnesty.
So Reagan, ironically, how ironic that the amnesty bill certainly did play a role, and it's the last major reform that allowed more people in large to scale. But then you have the Bill Clinton years. And unfortunately, it was a shift to this criminalization and viewing the hardening the border. And then when you fast forward to Obama, it was the Faustian bargain. He was aiming to get 11 million people regularized status, the 11 million that were here, in exchange for, that was the theory, hardening the border even more. And making what had been non-felonious, let alone misdemeanors, become crimes by crossing the border. So there's a trajectory of the law, and the conventional wisdom is every 10 years we'll revisit immigration reform. But now, because it's become such a useful tool to divide us politically, it's just a recurring theme. And on the editing, correcting the record, we need to correct the record. I have to figure out the best way to do that. One way is we've created the Sanctuary Oral History Archive at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, UC Berkeley. But we need to write the books. We need to get Cynthia's chapter out. We need to do more research and more writing. I need to quit my job and work with Cynthia and others to get it done or find a patron. But you're absolutely right. It needs to be corrected because it's incomplete. I'm not suggesting it's nefarious, but it's definitely incomplete.
Again, I had limited time. I was under a deadline for this, but I was saddened by what I felt. The secondary scholarship was still back, you know, in the 80s, where things at the time they were being written. So I didn't have that wonderful seminal work, you know, that can help us understand this. And I felt it really powerfully at the 2016 election when I was handing in my chapter, and it was like, oh my God, there's so much to know and so much to write and research. It was overwhelming to me. Join the historians you're teaching, right? That's what we need to do.
I have to jump off, but I want to thank everyone. I also want to note that we are products of our time, and formal leadership, so much of the writing focuses on the male side of our faith traditions. And I think there's a gender issue. And that's another very interesting layer that might someone might want to explore. But I have to say goodbye. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Cynthia, thank you so very much for this. This has been recorded by Penguin Radio. And so we'll be able to share this link with other people that couldn't come for this. But everybody thank have a wonderful so rest of yeah. your semester. And Cynthia, start thinking about that next chapter or that next book.
I'll work with Jordan. Bye-bye.